Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the emergence of a fifth woman claiming to have been sexually assaulted by Roy Moore when she was a minor. This following a call from the Republican leader of the U.S. Senate demanding that Moore step down as the Republican candidate for the Senate race in Alabama. Asked about Lee Kaufman's account of being sexually assaulted by Roy Moore when she was 14 and Moore was 32, Mitch McConnell replied, quote, "I believe the woman, yes." Diane Winston, who holds the Knight Chair in Media and Religion at the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism and is the publisher of Religion Dispatches, joins us to discuss whether or not a pedophile could be elected to the United States Senate by the Republican voters of Alabama. We'll also try to assess what possible strategy could be behind Stephen Bannon's championing of far-right fringe candidates and why Bannon thinks Roy Moore, Chemtrails Kelly in Arizona, and convicted felon Michael Grimm in New York could make America great again. Then we'll go to Jerusalem to speak with Israeli journalist and historian Gershom Gorenberg, who is the author of The Unmaking of Israel and a senior correspondent at The American Prospect, where he has an article, In the Saudi Game of Thrones, A Prince Knocks Over the House of Cards. He joins us to discuss what machinations and war plans, as well as financial deals, are underway within the secret alliances between Jared Kushner, the Saudi Crown Prince MBS, and his mentor, the leader of the Emirates MBZ, and Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Then finally, we'll look into the war of words between Donald Trump and the former director of National Intelligence, Clapper, and the director of the CIA, Brennan, following Trump's remarks in Asia that he believed Vladimir Putin had nothing to do with interfering in our elections. Ali Watkins, a national security correspondent for Politico, joins us to discuss Trump's subsequent correction of his remark to say that he believed Putin believed what he said, then the Russian claim that the conversation never took place, and Brennan's remark that Trump is being played by Putin. And joining us now is Diane Winston, who holds the Knight Chair in Media and Religion at the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism, and she is also the publisher of Religion Dispatches. Welcome to Background Briefing, Diane Winston.
Thank you, Ian. It's good to be with you today.
Well, thank you, Diane. And today, a fifth woman came forth to accuse the Republican U.S. Senate candidate in Alabama, Roy Moore, of sexual misconduct. In this case, it was Beverly Young Nelson. She said that Roy Moore attacked her when she was 16, and he was a DA in Alabama, I think about 32 years of age at the time. And she said, "I tried fighting him off while yelling at him to stop, but instead of stopping, he began squeezing my neck, attempting to force my head onto his crotch." And she said that Moore warned her that no one would believe you if she were to tell anybody about what happened in his car. So this is an extraordinary situation, and it has gone beyond he said, she said. Of course, the weaselly mantra that we hear from Republicans, although their ranks are starting to thin, is that if this were true, then he should step down. There's this caveat, if this were true. But at what point does overwhelming truth and evidence trump those weasel words?
One of the most interesting things we've seen in public life lately, Ian, is that facts and truth cannot stop weaselly words. Instead, weaselly words turn facts and truths into fake news. So I am not totally convinced that people who want to believe in Roy Moore will be swayed by Nelson's very eloquent and horrifying testimony. If you don't want to believe someone, you will find reasons not to believe them. And we've seen that time and again, whether it's about climate change or Trump and Russia or various politicians or candidates. Fake news has become a way to undermine anything's credibility.
So what then do you think will be the impact of Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell's statement when he was asked by reporters about whether or not he believed Lee Kaufman, who was in the Washington Post article, she's the 14-year-old who alleged that Roy Moore picked her up at a bus station in front of the courthouse and promised to babysit her while her mother went inside to do with a family court matter. And then later he called her up and arranged to meet her around the corner from her mother's house, and then took her to his place in the woods and then stripped her down, applied her with alcohol, and tried to have sex with her. Now, when asked about Lee Kaufman's account of this sexual assault when she was 14 and Roy Moore, the district attorney, was 32 years of age, Mitch McConnell, the Republican leader of the Senate, said, "I believe the woman, yes." So, I mean, does he have some weight? I mean, he is the Republican leader of the Senate, and this is the candidate for the U.S. Senate. And by all political calculations, it would seem that the leader of the Senate, holding onto a thin margin, would want an extra Republican in his chamber. But in this case, he's going against logic and saying, "I don't want this guy."
Well, this game is being played out at another level, and that's a level of the future of the Republican Party. And insofar as Moore has been pushed by Steve Bannon, and Bannon sees this as a way to disrupt and destroy the traditional GOP, which McConnell is a representative, it's not just about this particular candidacy of Roy Moore. It's about what is the Republican Party going to look like next year or the year after.
Well, if that's the case, then what is Steve Bannon's vision here? I mean, I, for the life of me, do not understand why he thinks that Roy Moore, Chemtrails Kelly, the convicted felon Michael Grimm in New York, Foster Freeze, this extraordinary motley collection of fringe Tea Party nutcases, how are they going to make America great again?
I can't pretend to understand Bannon's mind, but it does seem as if he has a vision of America that is nativist, isolationist, white supremacist, that can pardon all the people whom you mentioned, because in a larger way, they represent the same goals and ideals that he does. And so, whereas you or I may not understand why this looks good to him, I take it on faith that it does, and that it's expedient to support people like Roy Moore.
And again, I'm speaking with Diane Winston, who holds the Knight Chair in Media and Religion at the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism, and she's also the publisher of Religion Dispatches. Well, there may be another explanation for Steve Bannon, and that is that he has already sort of gotten this reputation as a sort of genius strategist, and it may not be really that well earned. I mean, maybe the real story is that he's basically a failed Hollywood screenwriter, just like Ayn Rand was. He just knows how to whisper in the ears of bilious billionaires to throw tons of money at you. And, you know, David Horowitz has learned that too, that you can get billionaires to give you money, particularly if you're a prodigal son who's flirted with the left and now want to embrace the right. I mean, is it possible that the press have just sort of gone overboard with Bannon and made him into this guru that he's really not?
Well, you know, it's very fashionable to heap everything at the feet of the press. And to the extent that Bannon is a colorful character who was a new face to many mainstream media reporters and thus an interesting person for copy, yes, the press has had something to do with creating him. To me, the larger question is not only is Bannon truly a threat, but what has he been doing that is most threatening? So not the man, but his mission. And one of the things that is most insidious is his charge of fake news that, along with Donald Trump, has put the mainstream media in such a precarious position. The mainstream media is not infallible, and it has, you know, definitely has its problems. But by and large, most reporters are honest people trying to help readers or listeners or viewers understand the world around them so they can make better decisions about their lives. And to think what they are doing is fake is, and to actually have like 60% of Republicans believe what they read is fake is horrifying. And I think that is why Bannon is so dangerous. Whether or not he's the real deal is secondary, but he's managed to do some very real damage.
Well, it's so interesting the way that he conflates the enemy in ways that appear to be code to his supporters and followers inside of that Fox, Breitbart, Sinclair bubble. He refers to the Washington Post story, and Diane, you teach journalism, and surely you agree with me that that was a very highly sourced, buttoned-down story with 30-plus witnesses, four women who all claimed to have been sexually assaulted by Roy Moore. And now, since that story's come out, a former district attorney in Alabama who worked in the office with Roy Moore said that that was his reputation amongst his co-workers, that he would troll the malls looking for teenage girls and go to high school games looking for teenage girls. And now, of course, we've had the fifth woman coming forth today via Gloria Allred. But let's start with that question first. What do you think of, as a journalist and a teacher of journalism, what do you think of the Washington Post story?
The Washington Post story, and this goes to the comments I just made about fake news and how people like Bannon have befuddled the public. The Washington Post story was a solid story. And if you read Beverly Young Nelson's press conference, which she herself says not interpreted by news media, she very clearly said that she and her husband both voted for Trump and that this has nothing to do with Democrats or Republicans. It has to do with a man who attacked her when she was a teenager. So the fact that people can look at this journalism, whether it's Post or the New York Times or CNN, and basically call it into suspicion is unthinkable. It shows where emotion can just, can just trump reason. Because this is what journalism should be. It's factual. It's sourced. It's supported, and you have the actual person's words to back it up.
Well, just back to what I wanted to mention about what Bannon said in response to the Washington Post story and how it has put Roy Moore's candidacy in jeopardy, even though the Republican voters of Alabama, many of them don't seem to be bothered by it, which is in itself an extraordinary situation and something that we could have a long conversation about. But just in terms of what Bannon has said, he said, and it sounded to me like code to his supporters and followers, was that this is the Amazon Bezos Washington Post doing to Roy Moore what they did to Donald Trump with the Billy Bush video, meaning the Access Hollywood tape. Well, number one, the Access Hollywood tape was the horse's mouth, for God's sake. It was Donald Trump himself talking about grabbing women by the private parts. So I don't know how, I just find it so extraordinary that they talk in these conspiratorial Bilderberg kind of language, but it's all so phony and so false, and yet it's believed.
It's very distressing for the future of our country and our democracy that people can believe the smoke and mirrors that Bannon projects above the hard facts that the news media is reporting. And there's something terribly wrong with our educational system that so many people seem to lack the critical thinking skills that would allow them to distinguish lies from truth. So, yes, I think that we are in a very difficult period, and that at some point we need to start rebuilding the public educational system, and we need to think about what it means to be a citizen. Maybe we need to reinstitute more civics in school. I do think that this is going to eventually boomerang on the evangelicals, because as someone who does teach younger students, college students, I've seen the way people who have grown up in religious households are distressed by the fact that their older co-religionists can accept someone like Roy Moore or Donald Trump, who so thoroughly nullifies their understanding of what it means to be a Christian. So Christians may say that they support people like Trump or Moore because they're doing God's work, but there are many younger evangelicals out there who find that very problematic, and that's going to catch up with them sooner or later.
Well, to your earlier point about education or the lack thereof, or the diminution of education in this country, it strikes me that we do have a critical choice, and that is whether we are passive consumers or active citizens. And the pressures, societal, etc., have all seemed to me to be in the direction of making us consumers as opposed to citizens. As you mentioned, maybe we should start teaching civics again. Well, why did we stop teaching civics in the first place?
Well, maybe part of that is because we've confused our role as consumers and our role as citizens. I still remember being so surprised when after 9/11, George Bush suggested we all go to Disneyland or we all shop. I don't remember the exact quote, but the point was being good citizens meant being good consumers. And the way we supported the country was to spend money. So I think you've hit on a very important and thorny subject, which is, what do we stand for as a people, and what do we think is at the heart of our American identity? What does it mean to be an American? And for me, it has less to do with consuming and more to do with being civil.
Well, as Thomas Jefferson said, an ignorant people cannot remain a free people. And it is troubling that we as a country do not have a consensus about what is true and what is real. And that, of course, has been what Putin has so successfully done with the Russian media, which he now controls, creates a constant sense of confusion and conspiracy, which is basically what RT does over here. You know, it appeals to both the far left and the far right and then puts a bunch of conspiracy in the middle. And this is what seems to be the the Roy Moore defense, that this is a conspiracy, you know, that somehow it's the Washington Post. Actually, today he named Mitch McConnell in a fundraising appeal. Roy Moore, reaching out to his supporters, said, "Mitch McConnell's plot to destroy me." That was the plot line. So it's not just the Amazon Bezos, Washington Post, and the Democratic Party. It's now Mitch McConnell. Pretty strange bedfellows.
Yeah, it is an unexpected development to find Mitch McConnell on the bad side of the conservative wing of the Republican Party. But again, I think it's important to remember that the majority of Americans probably do agree with you that Roy Moore did most likely assault these women, and I think it's a small minority, or maybe not so small minority, that doesn't agree with us. It's just that the people who don't agree get more press. So I think there have always been people in the country who have an alternate point of view. It's just that developments in technology have made them more visible.
Well, just in closing, what's your sense of is there any kind of magic bullet that could bring us back to the days of Walter Cronkite when everybody believed what Uncle Walter was saying, and it wasn't considered fake news?
And we can't go back to the days of three major networks and, you know, gray-haired older white men pronouncing the truth to us. You know, this is the way it is on this particular day. But I think we could find a new way to move forward where we had more assurances that the news media was credible, it was reliable, and it was serving the public. How we get from here to there, I think, will be a series of steps where we have more interactions between journalists and citizens and more transparency and maybe, you know, better civics lessons in our schools. Because as you said, I believe it was Jefferson who said he'd rather, if he had a choice of a free press or a government, he'd rather have a free press. And what needs to happen is for Americans to understand why he said that and why that's so important.
Well, Diane Winston, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thanks, Ian. Looking forward to talking to you again.
Well, thank you, Diane. And again, I've been speaking with Diane Winston, who holds the Knight Chair in Media and Religion at the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism. And she's also the publisher of Religion Dispatches. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back and go to Jerusalem to talk with the author of an article in the Saudi Game of Thrones, A Prince Knocks Over the House of Cards. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now from Jerusalem is Gershom Gorenberg, who is a historian and journalist, who is a senior correspondent for The American Prospect. He blogs at southjerusalem.com, and his books include The Accidental Empire, Israel and the Birth of Settlements, 1967 to 1977, The End of Days, Fundamentalism and the Struggle for the Temple Mount, and his latest book is The Unmaking of Israel. And he has an article at The American Prospect, In the Saudi Game of Thrones, A Prince Knocks Over the House of Cards. Welcome to Background Briefing, Gershom Gorenberg.
Nice to be with you again.
Well, thank you, Gershom. And clearly we know that there's a friendship, at least that's how it's being reported, between Jared Kushner and Mohammed bin Salman, MBS. His mentor, apparently, is MBZ. And we know that Jared is very close to Netanyahu. When Netanyahu stayed with his family in New Jersey, Jared gave up his bedroom for now Prime Minister Netanyahu. So let's start with that triumvirate. Is it a triumvirate?
Well, I don't have any evidence to believe that this is all a set of coordinated moves between the three of them. I would say that there's two sets of connections here. One connection is one of tone and emotion, I think, between Kushner and, even more importantly, Trump and the Crown Prince, MBS. And that is a preference for action and at least a suspicion that it's not always very well thought out. If there's, on the one hand, that creates approval from the White House for Saudi moves that may not be well considered. And on the other hand, it may give the Crown Prince a feeling that he can go ahead with things because the most important ally, even still, despite strained relationships, the United States, will back him up. On the Saudi Israeli front. Once again, there is no sign of a coordinated set of actions here. What is true is that both Saudi Arabia and Israel are very, very afraid of Iran. They both feel that that threat is on their border. In the Saudis' case, in Yemen, and in the Israeli case, in the very, very strong position of Iran in both Syria and Lebanon. And that creates a certain commonality of interest. But the commonality only goes so far because, first of all, from all reports that I've heard, the Saudis have made very clear over and over again, including under the current regime, that any overt friendship with Israel is conditioned on dealing with the Palestinian issue, with an agreement with the Palestinians. And Netanyahu, as usual, is going nowhere fast on that one. And on the other hand, if, as some speculate, the hope from Riyadh was that by removing Prime Minister Hariri from Lebanon and basically leaving Hezbollah exposed as the only power there, it would encourage Israel to launch a war against Hezbollah, essentially do the Saudis' dirty work for them. There is very, very little sign that anybody in Israel, or for that matter, in Hezbollah, is interested in an armed conflict at the moment.
But that's not to say that Israel has to be concerned about how things have worked out in Syria. My understanding is that for the longest time, the attitude was, well, as long as Israel's enemies are killing each other, they don't care. But now that Assad, the Russians, the Iranians, Quds, and Hezbollah are the winners, for all intents and purposes, and there is a Shia crescent that King Abdullah of Jordan warned about, it has rapidly becoming a reality with a land corridor from Tehran through to Damascus and into Beirut. Surely that has changed the entire Middle East equation, and that must have Israeli defense planners concerned.
It certainly has them concerned, but there is a couple things to point out here. First of all, the concern is much more focused on Syrian territory and the whole Iranian alliance there than specifically Hezbollah. There is a restraining factor simply in the presence of the Russians. Israel does not want to get itself involved in a conflict with the Russian Air Force. And on the other hand, the Russians seem to be, at this point, somewhat at least restraining any Iranian actions in the direction of Israel. And while it appears that the Iranian Hezbollah alliance is mopping up in Syria, Hezbollah is still very tied down there, which seems to be, or at least that's the best analysis I've heard of why Hezbollah has been trying to make clear that it doesn't want a direct conflict with Israel. They, as I put it elsewhere, they already have a date tonight. That date is the continued conflict in Syria. So Israel is watching the situation in Syria very closely. It's very concerned about the Iranian role there and the risk of an Iranian-backed group attacking Israel on the line between Israel and Syria. But that's at this stage on the level of watchful waiting, not on the level of we're already in the middle of the crisis.
And again, I'm speaking with Gershom Gorenberg, who's in Jerusalem, where he's a historian and journalist and a senior correspondent for The American Prospect. He blogs at southjerusalem.com. His latest book is The Unmaking of Israel, and he has an article at The American Prospect in the Saudi Game of Thrones, A Prince Knocks Over the House of Cards. So if there's not necessarily some kind of war brewing there, and I think when you point out, Gershom, that the Saudis would like the Israelis to take on Hezbollah and Syria and, by extension, Iran. It also appears in many ways that both Netanyahu and MBS would like America to also take on Iran, wouldn't they?
Well, the question is what you mean by take on.
Well, somehow curtail, first of all, the person who's been most pushing getting out of the P5 plus one has been Netanyahu himself. And there are constant sort of rumors that the U.S. is, at least the elements within the U.S. government, are looking for some kind of, they've always wanted payback against Iran, going back to the hostage crisis. But the theory is that the adults in the room, meaning the generals, are restraining the more hawkish elements within the White House, including President Trump himself.
I'm not going to presume to guess what Donald Trump is going to do. If there's one thing we know, that that's a bad idea to guess what somebody's going to do when he doesn't know himself. Netanyahu has certainly been the most outspoken opponent of the deal on Iranian nuclear arms. It seems that he's been under pressure from European allies to soften his rhetoric on that, and is talking more about improving the deal than simply erasing it in recent days. But another factor here is that, in a large way, Netanyahu spent his political capital on the nuclear issue, which leaves him in a poorer position to press containment of Iran in conventional terms. And obviously you can't play it out the other way, but it's worth asking whether that was a mistake, that part of the reason that, you know, the sanctions are not available in the same way to use against Iran, for instance, on its involvement in Syria, because they were used and cashed in terms of the Iranian nuclear program. So I would say that Netanyahu would love to see America do something regarding the Iranian role in Syria. I don't have it. If he knows what that something is, he certainly hasn't made it public. And of course, he faces a very big problem there, which is the Trump-Putin friendship, because the United States may want to limit Iran, but it's pretty much played along with the Russian game in Syria since last January 20th. And that makes it very difficult to count on the United States doing anything in terms of Iran's foothold in Syria.
Well, short of another war, I think the next issue with Syria will be the reconstruction. And it's sort of incomprehensible to me that the Europeans and even the United States would consider reconstructing Syria while the Russians don't pony up. And Iran doesn't. And Hezbollah, I believe, is in financial trouble because of its involvement in the Syrian war. So how much is that a factor? In other words, the money angle.
Well, I'm not sure about that. But what I can say is that there's a difference between the Iranian and, for that matter, Russian forces having the upper hand right now in Syria and the war being over. Iran and its militia allies could occupy all of Syria, and that doesn't mean that the conflict will necessarily be over. They may face all sorts of continuing opposition on the ground that will, first of all, tie them down, be a continuing drain on them militarily, and second of all, stand in the way of reconstruction. So I think it's a little bit premature at this point to be talking about reconstruction in Syria, sad as that is, because of the tremendous level of destruction, the incredible number of people who have been displaced internally or have left the country entirely, and yet I don't see the reconstruction starting tomorrow. Of course, I would underline here, nobody has done a good job of predicting anything happening in Syria over the last 6 years, so I'm very hesitant to make any predictions.
Well, then, turning to Lebanon, Israel obviously is restrained, I think, from military action because of the 100,000-plus missiles that Hezbollah has hidden that are aimed at Israel and could reach the major cities and destroy high-rise buildings, etc., in an all-out war. So there is that restraint. And as you mentioned earlier, it looks like the Saudi strategy of exfiltrating Hariri, who has always been, his father was very much a Saudi dual citizen. MBS impetuously pulled money away from him and then had to restore it. I don't know quite how that's playing there, but my sense would be that the enormous influx of refugees into Lebanon might have changed the demographic picture a little bit. And wouldn't they all be predominantly Sunni refugees from Assad?
That's my guess, but I can't tell you the exact makeup. What I can say is the Lebanon has followed with the Syrian refugees something based on the experience with Palestinian refugees 70 years ago, which is they're not giving them citizenship. They're not making them partners in the country. On the other hand, it's a tremendous burden on Lebanon in all sorts of ways. And, you know, it's a strain on the country. And given the fragile nature of Lebanon, it's very clear that they will be excluded to the extent possible from any sort of political process there.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes then, is there another dimension to this, the Jared MBS, MBZ, Netanyahu relationship, in as much as Netanyahu has political problems from investigations into his finances? Jared has a massive white elephant or an albatross around his neck. When he was courting Ivanka, he bought the most expensive piece of real estate in the history of Manhattan, 666 Fifth Avenue. Then shortly thereafter, there was the 2008 crash. It's been underwater ever since. He's got a $1.2 billion balloon payment due at the end of next year. And he's been running around the world trying to raise money from the Russians, from the Chinese, etc., and using his government position to do so. And he apparently shook down the Qatari royals and basically said, if you give me $500 million, otherwise I'll let the Saudis go ahead and blockade you, which is what MBS has done. And it's obviously like the Yemen situation. It's an impetuous move that he hasn't necessarily thought through in terms of an end game. So this is an extraordinary dimension to have in foreign policy, the personal enrichment of a family. Now, maybe that's nothing new in the Middle East, but it's certainly new in the American context.
I'm not going to try to follow every detail of this, but it's clear that the Trump clan does not make much distinction between government and their personal business interests. I don't think that directly involves Netanyahu in any way. I think Netanyahu's biggest political issue right now is figuring out how to stave off the investigations.
Well, that much he's got in common with Donald Trump, right?
Yeah, that much he's got in common with Donald Trump. His way of handling Trump, by the way, has sort of been the pioneer internationally of that, is figuring out that if you just keep complimenting the guy, he'll lap it up, which does not necessarily mean that there's any policy agreement between them or that there's any policy at all from Washington. It just simply means that Netanyahu has, had the correct intuition to understand how to play Donald Trump. It seems that the Saudis do as well. One major difference here is that Netanyahu is in general risk-averse, and that certainly does not seem to be true of the current Saudi rulers, which is another respect in which the connecting of too many dots and assuming that there's Israeli-Saudi collusion here, in my view, is a mistake until at least some much more solid evidence surfaces.
But just in closing, though, Jared shook down the Qatari royals, the Al-Thanis, for $500 million for his underwater building. I'd be hard-pressed not to suspect that some of the confiscated wealth that MBS has taken from Alawid bin Talal and others might end up rescuing Jared. But that's just my own speculation. So I thank you for joining us from Jerusalem.
My pleasure, as always.
Thank you, Gershom. And again, I've been speaking with Gershom Gorenberg, who is a Jerusalem-based historian and journalist. He's a senior correspondent for The American Prospect. He blogs at southjerusalem.com. His latest book is The Unmaking of Israel, and he has an article at The American Prospect, In the Saudi Game of Thrones, A Prince Knocks Over the House of Cards. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the war of words between Donald Trump and the former director of national intelligence, Clapper, and the director of the CIA, Brennan. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Ali Watkins, who's a national security correspondent for Politico, who previously covered national security and foreign policy for BuzzFeed News, and before that covered national security for McClatchy Newspaper's D.C. Bureau. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ali Watkins.
Thanks for having me, Ian.
Well, thanks for joining us, Ali. And what do you make of this war of words between the president and the former heads of the intelligence community, General Clapper, the DNI, and the DCI, John Brennan? To back up a little, in his overseas trip, Donald Trump said that he had spoken with Putin, and Putin assured him that he had nothing to do with meddling in the U.S. elections, and he believed Putin. And then Trump had to revise those remarks by saying that he actually believed the American intelligence community. He just said that Putin believed what he was saying. And then, by the way, I have to add that now Putin and the Russians are saying that the conversation never took place. So
there's a lot of crossed wires here, apparently. the fight kind of that's again heating up between Trump and the intelligence community, this time in the shape of Jim Clapper and John Brennan. Not really surprising. I mean, we've seen this kind of ebb and flow throughout Trump's tenure. He's shown a repeated kind of disregard for the institution of the intelligence community, particularly when it comes to their INA, their analysis from earlier this year that Russia meddled in the 2016 election. So that has been a crux, that's been the issue between Trump and the IC basically since the night he was elected. But I think what's really interesting here, and I think it's kind of striking a lot of us today as we unpack some of this stuff that was said over the weekend with Trump and Putin, Trump is not helping himself here, and I think it's confusing almost as a reporter to see this dialogue is not getting any better for Trump. He says these things about Putin and it immediately blows back at him. And we see obviously Trump or Brennan and Clapper immediately kind of fire up the engine and get out there publicly and then say what the IC believes, etc. So, as far as the dialogue between Trump and Putin, that's been a really interesting escalation over the weekend. And we've all kind of been watching, I think, from the beginning of this, when is, Donald Trump is going to get an education in what it's like to deal with Russia very quickly. And I think particularly as we're dealing with this, the Russians now say this conversation never happened. I mean, this is 101 in dealing with the Kremlin. If you're going to allow yourself to be manipulated, they know how to do it.
Well, that's very much what Brennan said on Sunday. I think Mr. Putin is very clever in terms of playing to Mr. Trump's interest in being flattered. And also, I think Trump is, for whatever reason, either intimidated by Mr. Putin, afraid of what he could do or what might come out as a result of these Mueller investigations. So that apparently, well, I don't know whether Trump's replied to that. Mnuchin, I think, came to Trump's defense, but he's not exactly a very powerful, credible voice. So when did Trump, by the way, tweet out the insults against Clapper, Brennan, and Comey? He said, I mean, give me a break. They're political hacks. And he mentioned...
Yeah, I mean, that was why he started those attacks, I mean, months ago. You know, and like I said, we've just kind of seen them ramp up. He has these characters that he goes after. And it's interesting just to see. I mean, Putin was a trained KGB officer. You know, the KGB obviously being the Soviet intelligence apparatus that is just notoriously cunning and sly. And so this notion of, you know, Putin told me something, so I believe him, just speaks to this complete lack of understanding of who Putin is as a leader and also just Russian security history generally.
Well, what's happening with Pompeo? Already Pompeo's, we know coming in, before he got the job as to heading up the CIA, that he was very political. I won't describe him in Trump's description of being a political hack, but he was definitely extremely partisan, involved with that Benghazi fiasco. And recently we learned that Trump talked him into, I don't know how much he had to talk him into it, but at Trump's behest, the head of the CIA met with Bill Binney, a former NSA official who has a very unique theory about the Russian hack of the DNC, that it was actually conducted by somebody, an insider in American intel, not the Russians. Obviously, that's something that Trump wants to believe, but the idea that the head of the CIA would entertain that kind of conspiracy theory, let alone indulge the conspiracy theorist himself, has apparently got a lot of intelligence professionals upset. Is that what you're hearing?
Yeah. You know, Pompeo's had this weird relationship with the workforce, and this kind of tracks to the bigger theme with any CIA director, just that I've learned from kind of covering the agency. You have directors put in, obviously, they are politically appointed. They're appointed by the president. But those, the personalities that are appointed, you know, they're either kind of agency guys or they're political guys serving the agency. You know, that's a really key distinction. John Brennan was always an agency guy. He came up through the CIA. He did some work in the White House, but he eventually went back to the agency. Pompeo has, since day one, been a politician at heart, you know, who is now at the agency. And he's been met with kind of, you know, fairly acceptable reviews at the agency, but this, you know, he continues, he has these moments where you still see the politician kind of come out to him. And whether it's, you know, at a public speech, whether it's at a forum, he said a few things at the Aspen National Security Forum that, you know, didn't necessarily really put him at odds with the IC, but he kind of lined up with Trump on the Russia analysis from the intelligence community. And then you have this Bill Binney thing, where obviously he's meeting with this very controversial whistleblower, specifically at the behest of the president. And it comes down to this question of, does Mike Pompeo have the president's best interest at heart, or does he have the agency's best interest at heart? And you're talking about a national security organization that is still kind of recovering from the Bush years of when, you know, they were used by the president and they did take the fall for a lot of presidential initiatives like the torture program. And, you know, it's an agency that wants an advocate for them in the seventh floor office. So as we see Pompeo keep making these kind of strange steps that align more with the White House than Langley, I think that's going to be a problem for him with the workforce.
And what do you think, Ali Watkins, is going on, not so much with Mueller's investigation of Manafort, although Manafort has clearly been on the Russian payroll via the Ukrainians, and his deputy in Ukraine is a former GRU colonel. So there's a lot to look at there. But Flynn himself, the latest revelations about Flynn perhaps being offered as much as $15 million to carry out some kind of kidnapping or rendition of Fethullah Gulen, who the Turkish President Erdogan desperately wants to hold accountable for everything that's gone wrong in Turkey. That's an extraordinary story in itself. But what I found most alarming about that most recent report was that when he was National Security Advisor for that brief tenure, apparently he did, Michael Flynn, act at the behest of the Turkish government and hold back on the Kurds taking Raqqa, and instead allowed Erdogan's sort of proxy army of Sunni tribes, which ended up being totally infiltrated by the Islamic State, and they, of course, went nowhere. But it did slow down by several months the recapture of Raqqa. That, I've never heard of anything like that, where a U.S. National Security Advisor has run his national security priorities through a foreign actor at the benefit of the Turkish government, not for the benefit of the American government that he serves.
I mean, it's a pretty sensational storyline, and I don't know that I can think of any comparable situation either. But, you know, as far as Mike Flynn goes, I think we all kind of saw the writing on the wall as the reporting started coming out, I guess, probably 7-8 months ago now, like when he eventually was pressured to step down from the White House. It was pretty clear that there was, at the very least, a potential FARA, Foreign Agent Registration Act violation. So that you're kind of seeing this public posturing of, like, Flynn sorting it out, you know, et cetera. He's sort of the next shoe to drop, or the conventional wisdom next shoe to drop as far as potential Mueller indictment. But there has also long been speculation that Flynn has slipped and is now cooperating. And we don't know that for sure. But some of that appeared to be telegraphed just through certain, you know, public posturings and statements, you know, in the early days of Flynn's downfall, for lack of a better term.
Well, that could be bad for Trump, right? Trump leaned on Comey to go easy on Flynn, and that may well be a part of what Mueller's looking into. But
I mean, I think the real problem that Trump could have with Flynn, you know, all of these other people, like your Manafort's and your Rick Gates, it's relatively easy, if not genuine, for the Trump camp to kind of distance themselves from them. They could say, you know, they were only here during the campaign, they were fired. Michael Flynn comes down, you're talking about a man who held a high-ranking national security position in the White House. It's not going to be easy to distance themselves from Michael Flynn.
Well, it seems, though, that there is also, obviously, there is the pardon power that's sort of in the background in all of this. But what's your sense, then, of whether or not Trump is vulnerable in that regard from the idea that he's flipped? I mean, let's face it, Barack Obama, in his meeting with Trump when he was handing the baton over to Trump, told Trump, he said, for God's sake, well, you know, if you want my advice, don't hire Michael Flynn. And then Trump's been running around saying what a great guy he is. I don't know what that says about Trump's judgment. I mean, it's just shocking that look how he did not take Obama's advice and look where it's got him, not to mention how much time he spends trashing Obama.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the question on pardons is not really one that I have good insight to, mostly because those conversations are happening, you know, White House side, not really within the intel world. But Mike Flynn's position in that White House is in and of itself kind of exhibit A of how poorly the Trump administration kind of gamed out or vetted a lot of these people that had initially stuck into high-ranking positions.
Well, that's, yes, isn't it interesting that the only names that Trump gave early, once he was elected, in terms of his team, in terms of foreign policy, the two names he offered up to the Washington Post were George Papadopoulos and Carter Page, both of whom are giving him heartburn, right?
Yes, I mean, that interview has come back to haunt him many, many times at this point, and I suspect it's going to continue to do so.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes, just going back to the war of words going on between Clapper and Trump and Trump and Brennan and back and forth. And my sense of Trump is that he really is a reality TV personality. And that's been his most recent expertise and experience, and he seems to be very much in that mold, and that he's sort of running the presidency like a reality TV show. And it's just extraordinary to see a reality TV personality on the world stage, because by definition, reality television is kind of made up drama. It's not inherently real drama, but the world stage operates surely by its own rules. And it's a very serious place, the world stage. It's not a place for dramatic fantasies known as reality TV. It's reality, in other words. That's the point I'm trying to make here in a long-winded way.
Yes, though it's certainly not stopping the administration from trying, right? I think it's most indicative when you look at these tweets and you look at some of the things that he's tweeted, particularly on these foreign trips and this Asia trip. We're seeing certain escalations in the way he tweets and the way he's talking about world leaders, and it does match with more of a reality TV entertainment persona than any kind of statesman position. But then again, Donald Trump was a reality TV star before he became a politician, and he kind of ran on that kind of platform. So this is exactly what I think a lot of people voted for.
Well, just in closing, though, do you think that if Mike Pompeo, who apparently is angling for the Secretary of State's job, and he does give Trump the daily briefing, and apparently they've sort of bonded, what's your sense of who might replace Pompeo at CIA? I mean, presumably Trump could do worse, I take it.
Yeah, I mean, there's been rufflings occasionally. There's always this persistent rumor that, when Tillerson eventually frustrates Trump enough that he gets fired, Pompeo will move over to the CIA and there will be someone else appointed. There's been a couple names thrown out there. Tom Cotton is kind of one of the leading members of that pack, Senator Tom Cotton from Arkansas. As I've kind of fished around with my sources, a lot of that stuff is rumbling, and I don't know that any of it has really, nobody's really chomping at the bit to kind of take that over or tackle that potential issue right now.
Well, Ali Watkins, I thank you very much for joining us. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Ali Watkins, who's a national security correspondent for Politico, who previously covered national security and foreign policy for BuzzFeed News, and before that covered national security for McClatchy Newspapers DC Bureau. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. We can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.